It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Maya Angelou is a writer, performer, teacher, and director whose autobiographies include I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and Gather Together in My Name. If America didn't know about Maya Angelou before President Clinton took office, it certainly did after the reading of her poem On the Pulse of Mourning at his inauguration. Her most recent book, Mom and Me and Mom, came out earlier this year, and we asked her how she would describe her mother, Vivian Baxter.
She was hilarious. She was really, she could have been a stand-up comedian. She liked to make people laugh. She had a way with words, so that, and she didn't mind cursing. And not being a curser myself at first, it shocked me so, because I had lived with my grandmother, my father's mother, from the time I was 3 until I was 13. And that in a little village in the South, and my grandmother was very, not only very private and very proper, she was very religious. And so not only did we not curse, we didn't speak loudly in the house. I went to my mother in San Francisco, and she had records on the record player, and she danced in the middle of the dining room floor and in the kitchen, and she cursed whenever she liked. And sometimes I think she cursed just to shock people. And she achieved it with me, because she shocked me so that I thought she was a foreign being. And at first, I really didn't want to call her mother. And she said, you'll have to address me as something. So she asked, why didn't I want to call her mother? I said, she was nothing like a mother. I thought mothers were like my grandmother, where everybody spoke softly, and you didn't dare question what they said to be the rules. Vivian Baxter said, if you don't like what I'm saying, ask me why I say it, and then ask me to repeat it and tell me why you don't like it. And finally, I told her I'd rather call her Lady, and because she was so pretty, and she was just, she reminded me of what a lady should be like. She said, all right, I'll introduce myself to everyone as Lady.
At first, you didn't smile around your mother. Your mother had to ask you to smile.
Yes.
What did you learn from that day?
Well, I learned, she said, if you have one smile in you, give it to me. Give it here in the house with people, to people who care about you, who care to put food on the table and clothes on your back and shoes on your feet. Don't be dour and sour here in the house, and go out and to complete strangers, widen your lips and give a big smile. She said, that's not fair. But that made sense to me. And once when I did smile, she made me laugh. She said, oh, my baby has the prettiest smile. Oh, my goodness. And she called up people and said, my baby just smiled at me. And I learned, well, you know, you can be generous. And a generous action can be rewarding, not just to the person who received the action, but to the person who gives the generosity.
Your mother could be very tough, but yes. she was also had this very understanding side. You became pregnant with your son Guy when you were in high school, and this was during the 40s, at a time when such a thing would bring or could bring shame to a family. But your mother was amazingly understanding and supportive in a way that a lot of parents might not have been.
It's true. My mother asked me, my stepfather had asked me the night before how far pregnant was I. And I told him I would be having the baby in about 3 weeks. So my mother was up in Alaska with one of their gambling joints. And he called her, and she flew down that morning. And she walked in the house. She said, you're more than any 3 weeks pregnant. I said, I know, I'm going to have the baby in about 3 weeks. She asked me, do you know who the father is? I said, of course. I only had sex with him once. She said, "And do you love him?" I said, "No." She asked, "Does he love you?" I said, "No." She said, "Then we're not going to ruin three lives. That's all. We're going to have a fine baby. That's all there is to it." And she never once made me feel I had brought shame on the family. Never once. She just was that kind of woman. And she loved my son. And he adored her.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is writer, performer, teacher, director Maya Angelou. Her latest book is Mom and Me and Mom. It's about her life with her mother, Vivian Baxter. Ms. Angelou, would you have become the person you are without your mother, without Vivian Baxter?
No. No, no. There's so many things I did because she said, "If you want to do it, go do it. You want a job, go get it." And I went down to get a good job on the streetcars because I'd seen women on the streetcars. I hadn't noticed that the women were all white. We're just women. And I liked the way their uniforms fit them. And they had caps with bibs on them. And they had the little money changes and on the belt. And they just looked smart. So I said I wanted a job on the streetcars. My mother said, "Go get it." When I went down to get to apply, the people at the desk wouldn't even give me an application. And I went back to my mother, really drained. She asked me, "Do you know why they wouldn't?" I said, "Yes." She asked me why. I said, "Because I'm a Negro." She said, "That's right. But do you want the job?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Go get it. Take a good book down with you. You'll be there in the office as soon as the secretaries get there. You sit there. And you leave for lunch after they leave. But be back before they get back. And you sit there and read."
You brought Dostoevsky with you, right?
I did. Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, all of them. But the truth is, after the second day, I wanted to come home. I just didn't dare let my mother know I wasn't as strong as she thought I was. So I sat there for 2 weeks. Every day. And the girls who worked in the office, some of them I had helped with their schoolwork out of George Washington High School. But they came by, they made all sorts of remarks, racist remarks, and pretended their lips were big and pushed them out at me. And oh, it was terrible. But I sat there. And finally, a man came out of an office and said, "Come in here." And he asked me, "Why do you want a job with the Market Street Railway?" And I said, "Because I like people and I like the uniforms." It's very silly. He asked me what experience I had. I told him the biggest lie in life. I told him I had been the chauffeurette for Mrs. Annie Henderson in Stamps, Arkansas. And that was my grandmother, who had hardly ever been in a car, let alone had somebody drive her around in it. But I got the job.
You were, in fact, the first African-American woman to be a streetcar conductorette in San Francisco. And
that's true.
You relied on your mother's support. There are numerous examples of this in the book, and there's a great one about when, you know, you're in your 40s and they're filming your screenplay, Georgia, in Sweden, and you called and you asked your mother to come over and be with you and lend moral support. Did you, in some ways later, want Vivian to be there to mother you, to perhaps compensate for... Go ahead.
That's what I asked her. I said, "Please come and mother me. I need some mothering." And I said, "I'll send a check in the mail. As soon as you get it, come over." She said, "When I get back, my check will be there waiting for me. But if anything is leaving for Stockholm tomorrow morning, I'll be there at some time tomorrow."
Examples like this, do they symbolize in some ways perhaps an effort on your part to compensate for the years you missed being with her as a child, because you really came to realize that your mother was an amazing person?
Yes, but I didn't realize that for many years. I was 22 when it just hit me like I don't know what, I mean, like some physical slam. I was walking down the street with her, and she said, "You know, baby, I think you're the greatest woman I've ever met." I was 22. She owned hotels and pool halls and had big diamond earrings on, and I wouldn't take a penny from anyone. And I didn't know what to say. She said, "Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mary McLeod Bethune, and my mother," she said, "you're in that category." And she gave me a kiss and walked across the street to get into her car. And I continued down the street and got into the streetcar on Fillmore Street. And I sat there and thought, suppose she's right. Suppose I am going to be somebody. She's very intelligent, and she said she was too mean to lie. And so suppose she's telling the truth, then maybe I'd better stop doing some of the things I was doing. I stopped cursing, stopped smoking, and stopped drinking. I didn't drink much anyway, and I didn't stop smoking, but I did stop cursing. From that day to this, and that was 60 years ago.
Maya Angelou has been my guest. Her latest book is Mom and Me and Mom. Maya Angelou, it's been an honor to have you on Essential Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Essential Pittsburgh will continue after this break on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Since the success of her first novel, The Joy Luck Club, author Amy Tan has told the compelling stories of Chinese and Chinese-American women, particularly mothers and daughters. In her new novel, The Valley of Amazement, the story is set in the early part of the 20th century and told from the point of view of a part American girl living in China. Amy Tan started by explaining how the staging of the book's characters in a Chinese courtesan house was partly inspired by what she learned from an old photograph.
The photo showed 10 women, and 5 of them were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing in my favorite photo of her that sits on my desk and serves as my inspiration. These women were courtesans, the 10 beauties of Shanghai, 1910, 1911, and that's exactly when my grandmother's photo was taken.
So what did the clothes look like? Describe what these women were wearing.
They were wearing a headband that formed a V at the top of their head with pearls, embroidery. They had a very tight jacket on with the collar that went up to just below the earlobes. The sleeves were tight and stopped just below the elbow, and there was white lining, matching bracelets, tight pants, and it was taken in what was known as a Western photo studio with a painted backdrop and also with pots of flowers around. That all of those details were specific to courtesans, I found as I read more in that book. The one detail that the academics I consulted with told me was the most telling was the photo studio. And they said no woman went there except courtesans. It was as if that place was there only for courtesans. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm thinking of all the reasons why she might have been wearing this outfit and why she went to the photo studio. And I thought of myself, you know, maybe I inherited her love of costumes and, you know, I play in a band and I wear a costume. You know, maybe she did something similar. But it just kept coming back to this possibility. She had been a courtesan.
So at this point, it might be a good idea to explain what exactly a courtesan is for anybody that doesn't understand.
I don't think we have a concept that's similar anymore. Courtesans were actually courted. They were in these very lavish places. The houses and the courtesans of that time had Western furnishings. The courtesans, in fact, popularized Western culture in Shanghai. They innovated fashion. They, you know, ate American food, Western pastimes such as pool and billiards. They also were the ones who chose which men were going to receive their intimate favors behind the doors of the boudoir. They were also typically very young. They started their career at about 14 or 15. They were done. They were washed up by the time they were 21 or 22. And they had better have had something lined up before that happened. Otherwise, it would be a progression to a second-class courtesan house or to a flower opium house or the streets or something worse.
So not in a situation where you were able to choose, where you were...
You would try to campaign to become the concubine of one of your patrons. And that would be probably the best situation you could have. If you were extremely talented, you might be able to make a go at it as an entertainer. Very rarely would you become the first wife to a, you know, any kind of man of substance.
What did you figure out or come to learn about how your grandmother might have fit into this context?
You know, I'll never really know for sure unless her ghost was standing here saying, yes, it's true. I spent a lot of time reading much more about courtesans, and I talked to relatives, and I saw the contradictions in the stories. I was told that she was an old-fashioned, traditional woman, very quiet, a stay-at-home kind of mom. And then somebody told me, oh, she was known for having a fiery temper and that she had very strong opinions. And if you didn't listen to her, you were, quote, sorry later. The other people said she was the fourth wife, but she was the favorite, which was rather unusual. The other wives in the family were younger. They were 16. The other story that was told is that she was raped by this rich man and forced to become his wife. I examined the story again in light of what was said, and I thought, there's something very puzzling. The story was that the man came into her room when she visited with her half-sister. The half-sister got up, the rich man took her place and held a knife to her throat and said, if you don't marry me, I'll kill you. And another story was, he held the knife to his throat and said, if you don't marry me, I'll kill myself. Now, I started realizing the knife is the red herring. Something just doesn't fit. Why would he, you know, need to say he's going to kill her? He was the patron of the island. He built all the schools, the roads, the hospitals, the water system. He was the hero. Why would he murder a woman and, you know, be thrown in jail? He had any woman he wanted. So who knows what the real story is. I don't know if it was love or they needed to have a story because she was a widow and to find some way of making it seem acceptable.
And did you ever come to find out what happened to her, what became of her?
She killed herself. She had a son, and she – this was the other thing. It was rather striking. She made him make a promise that if she delivered a son, it would be his first son. And in that case, he would buy her a house in Shanghai so she didn't have to live on this island where she had been taken. And I read later that that is what courtesans made their patrons promise, that if they became their concubines, that they would buy a place for them in Shanghai. Well, he reneged on his promise. And I don't know if she asked him soon after or if it was that she was nagging to him for a while, but a month after the baby was born on the New Year, she killed herself. She took an overdose of opium. It may have been accidental. You know, the family made a big point of it that she really did intend to do it because she ate sticky rice cakes, and that meant that it wouldn't have been able to come up as though the rice would stick to the innards and not be able to, be expelled somehow. But all these things, this emphasis on the knife and the rice cakes, and I started looking at it and saying, why were these points made? And it could be that it truly was that way, but there are little details that contradict what the former story was.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is author Amy Tan, whose new novel is The Valley of Amazement. So as you are processing all of this, Amy, and you know, considering what the photograph means, how did this end up morphing into the story that you tell in The Valley of Amazement?
Well, I was so obsessed with the idea that she had been a courtesan that I started researching everything I could find and everything on Shanghai of that period. And I decided, listen, I'm so deeply entrenched in this, I might as well just be there. I just want to be in Shanghai 1910 and figure out what life was like there. But more than that, my books have always been about self-identity, how we become who we are, or how I become who I became who I am. People think it's mothers and daughters, and that certainly is part of it. One of the greatest influences on me, and I think on many women, is their, you know, it's their mothers. The mothers have much to do with shaping them, shaping their rebelliousness, and also those traits that they have later in life that they swore they wouldn't have, they find they have them anyway. So I thought about how we were born into certain families. We have a birthright of some kind, and that all of this changes over time depending on what has happened to us. You know, whether it's war or hardship or trauma or the loss of a parent, the loss of somebody in the family, marrying somebody who turns out to be the wrong person, you know, being betrayed, going to school or falling out of school, all of those influences, how do we change at every turn? How do we not, I mean, what do we not change? What would we never change? How does it affect our notions of hope, trust, love? And that really is what the story is about. It is about abandonment in one sense, and that is a theme that runs in our family. My mother abandoned her three daughters in China and went to the United States. Her mother, my grandmother, abandoned my mother by killing herself. My mother was nine and wanted to go with her mother. She didn't understand where her mother went. So this story has some of that in it as well.
Did writing this book help provide insights into your relationship with your mother? Because I was reading that your relationship with your mother was sometimes quite rocky.
It was quite rocky when I was a teenager. And I think we got along better when I was in my 20s, but that was because I avoided topics. I avoided seeing her, bringing up anything that she would get upset about. So we weren't really able to talk. But at the same time, we were conspirators. We were our own little group of people isolated from the rest of the world when my father and brother died. No one else understood what that felt like and what that meant. My little brother, my mother, and I, we were like a cult of three, always thinking we're all going to die. It was a very strange time, and I tried to break away from that as well, you know, both adhering to one another and then trying to break out of it.
And you ended up defying her as a young adult. She wanted you to study medicine, and you wanted to be a writer.
Both my parents thought I should become a doctor. Here I had this chance. Some psychologist when I was 6 years old gave me an IQ test and said, she has what it takes to become a doctor. And verbal areas, no, not so much. You know, I would excel in math and all these hard sciences, but not the writing. And that proved throughout the years, whenever I took these aptitude tests, that was the case. It was always good in math, not so great in verbal areas. But when I got to college, I said, I love to read. You know, I'm going to change from pre-med to English major. And that's what I did.
And she didn't like that.
No, she was very disappointed. But I think I did it also because my father had died and I couldn't disappoint him. And I was a daddy's girl, and that was the person I would most have feared disappointing. And my mother, I just knew she would be angry. But she was, you know, and according to everything that ever happened in our lives, she would be disappointed with anything I did as far as I was concerned. I had that viewpoint when I was younger, and it changed. I look back now over time, and I think we had a closeness that through fighting, in a way, you have a closeness about many things that people don't have when they don't talk about it. She was a woman of very deep feelings, and I realized that's what I do in my writing, that my meaning in life is to think as deeply and to feel as deeply as I can. And writing pushes me toward that. You know, you read a story, you read fiction as you're writing it. You just say, oh, this is not reaching far enough. This is too easy. And you have to keep pushing yourself. That's something I learned from my mother, that she was a very deep feeler. She was a little too deep at times, you know, really intense, but a little too intense for survival. She was suicidal at the same time. She threatened that quite often. That's something I'm glad I did not inherit from my mother.
You ended up taking her on a trip. You would take your mother to China to see the daughter or one of them that had been left behind almost 40 years before. Describe what that was like and the impact it had on you.
She had actually gone to China before that. She left in 49. She went back in 79. She hadn't seen them in 30 years. And she told me that she didn't recognize them, of course, because they were, to her mind, old ladies. I went in 1987. For the first time, and I took her with me. It was a promise I made to myself when I thought she was having a heart attack, and I went to the phone and I said, oh, I don't know anything about her. Who was she? I said, if she lives, I'm going to listen from now on to all those horrible stories she has been trying to tell me, and I'm going to take her to China and meet these daughters of hers.
Who were you saying that to besides yourself?
I said, dear God, or Buddha, or whoever is listening. It was a moment of existential crisis because a lot of my mother was, at that moment, I said, a lot of who she is who I am. And if I don't know who she was, there's going to be a big piece missing out of my understanding of myself. So I also realized, you know, there was something that we hadn't talked about, you know, this love that we had and the worry she'd always had and that I should appreciate it. So I took her to China and I had a lot of myths blown. You know, I thought she always got into arguments with people because they didn't understand her English. But she had more arguments in China. You know, I ended up thinking that English had held her back. And she was still in China warning me, here I am, an adult, you know, be careful, you know, or don't buy that. You paid too much money for it, you know. And it was driving me crazy. I had to sleep in the same bed with her 24/7, and it was really difficult, but I knew it was the best thing I could ever do. And I came home and I started writing Joy Luck Club. I came home actually. Suddenly there was an offer for this book I had not written except for three stories. So it was like a magic time.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is author Amy Tan, whose new novel is The Valley of Amazement. You were talking about the Joy Luck Club just before that was published and became this huge success. You were a business writer.
Yes.
How did you go from that to writing fiction?
I was a freelance business writer, and somehow I fell into this subject of telecommunications, which was really expanding at that time because AT&T had broken up and everybody was vying for this piece of the pie. And I ended up getting a lot of clients. So I was very successful, had clients who loved me, and everybody would say, well, this is an ideal freelance career, but I was very unhappy. None of this was meaningful to me. I was very good at it. And I thought to myself, what's going to finally satisfy me? And I went to see a psychiatrist, and he was very helpful. He fell asleep 3 times. And that made me decide I should take care of my own need to find satisfaction in my life. And I started writing. I said, okay, I've always loved to read. And I used to write great letters to friends. People love those letters. And I would take jazz piano, improvisational jazz, and I would start writing fiction. And I'd see which one of them stuck. And guess which one stuck? I started reading books people recommended, writing short stories. I went to my first writer's workshop where I met Richard Ford, who has been a friend ever since. But I knew that's what I wanted to do from that one writer's workshop. My story was torn to bits, but it didn't feel bad at all. Because people were talking about what's the voice of the story, because the voice determines what story can be told. I thought, wow, this is interesting. And I decided I had to be serious about this fiction writing. I would continue with my work as a freelance business writer, but I would make time for writing fiction. Instead of working 90 billable hours a week, I would work only 50, and I would use the, quote, leftover time to write fiction. So I did that for, as much as I could. And every time I kind of forgot about writing the fiction, some strange thing would happen. You know, somebody would say, oh, you know that story you showed me? Well, I slipped it over to the editor of a little magazine, and they want to publish it. And I would get all excited. You know, it was a circulation of 300 newsprint kind of thing, $30. But it was a reminder to keep doing this. So that was my early writing.
So then the Joy Luck Club becomes this huge success, and then it's made into a movie.
That time was very difficult for me because I never expected to get published. I had made myself a reasonable goal to take fiction writing seriously by saying I would be published in a good little magazine, good literary magazine, by the time I was 70. And the little magazines that I had in mind were things like Grand Street, Tri-Quarterly, Paris Review. So when this happened, it was like winning the lottery without having ever bought a lottery ticket. I didn't trust it. I didn't know what was happening. I was happy before that, basically happy before that, except for my, working too many hours at something that was not as meaningful to me. But I was happy with my marriage. We owned a home, getting along with my mom. And I thought, this is going to change everything. This is going to mess things up because it's so seductive. And people were changing toward me. And, friends treated me suddenly a little differently. And it was frightening. I had to write something down to myself and say this is what's important because I don't want to get lost. I don't want to lose my moorings as to what's important. And I think it's very easy for people to do that. Sudden success, and it can go to your head.
So how did you manage to maintain an even keel after all this?
Well, I broke 3 teeth, molars, grinding my teeth at night. it's hard to say – if there's any way to stay even keeled about it. I had to remind myself the most important thing was family and to understand the reasons why I write, not to please people, but to really use it to discover something about myself.
Amy Tan's new novel is The Valley of Amazement, released earlier this month. She's in Pittsburgh and joined us in Studio A. Amy Tan, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
And more Essential Pittsburgh to come on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. One of America's favorite storytellers is Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket. His books are often categorized as young adult fiction, but many adults enjoy his classic 13-part collection, A Series of Unfortunate Events. His newest work is a 4-part prequel to the Unfortunate Events books. When we spoke with Daniel Handler, I started by asking him, who is Lemony Snicket?
Lemony Snicket is a mysterious and shadowy figure who narrates a sequence of books for which I'm at least partially responsible. He narrated a sequence of books about terrible things happening to orphans over and over again. That was called A Series of Unfortunate Events. And now there's a series called All the Wrong Questions, which is about his own apprenticeship in a secret organization where he's sent to a dreary and gray town full of mysterious and sinister goings-on.
Well, I understand that you told an editor in 1997 that your idea for a children's book was, in fact, terrible things happening to orphans over and over again. What was her reaction to your suggestion?
She said it was a good idea, and I felt bad because I had arranged to meet her in a bar and tell her this idea because I knew it was terrible, and I thought, I will tell you this idea, and you will tell me it was terrible, and then at least we'll be in a bar, so the whole thing won't be a complete waste. And instead, she said she liked it, which concerned me because I thought it meant that she was a lightweight, and then the next morning she was going to have to call me and say, you know, as so many women have said to me, last night was nothing, I made a terrible mistake. And so instead, it turns out she's a Canadian, she's a Winnipegger from Winnipeg.
And you like saying that.
And they drink like fish. And so she called the next morning and said, no, I still like it. And would you mind writing it down? She said to me the idea in a sequence of books. And I said, no, I think I would like to do that.
And so.
And here I am.
The city of Pittsburgh has really cleaned up its image, but at one time it was referred to as hell with the lid off. Do you see
Pittsburgh? I did not know that.
But the old pictures of Pittsburgh, I'm sure you've seen them with the smoke billowing from the mill. So do you see Pittsburgh as a fortunate or unfortunate place to be?
I have only the position of an outsider. But it seems like a lovely city to me. But I also appreciate a bit of gloom in my own city. So I'm from San Francisco, which has a nice foggy, oceanic gloom to it. And then there's Pittsburgh, which has the gloom of churning rivers and steel bridges and, you know, kind of sinister industry. So I never thought of it as hell with the lid off. But it has always seemed a little bit like a gray and lonely town. But I mean that as a deep compliment. I guess it depends what you like.
Could this be the inspiration for a story at some point?
Well, it didn't hurt. My second novel for adults, actually, Watch Your Mouth, takes place partially in Pittsburgh and features a creature coming rising out of the murky river to attack some innocent people, more or less innocent.
Images of Lemony Snicket show him as this shadowy character. He wears a fedora.
Yeah.
What inspired that image?
Well, when I first started writing A Series of Unfortunate Events, I realized that the narrator was this kind of lonely man, and that I shrouded him in mystery because I thought that was more interesting. And then we had the idea of publishing the books under the name of the narrator rather than the name of the author, which I thought would just make everything more interesting. And so then I asked my friend Meredith, she would take some pictures, and I had an old hat, and it started to snow, and I ran around in the snow, and she took a bunch of pictures from the back. It was quite a delightful afternoon, actually. We did it until about 5 o'clock when the sun set, and then we had bourbon old fashions, and then we had the photographs delivered and developed, and they looked very lonely and stark and old-fashioned, and it seemed like people were interested in that.
Daniel Handler is our guest. He's the author of the Lemony Snicket books. What's it like to write a darkly comic noir thriller?
Well, I find it delightful. I've long admired Raymond Chandler and some of the other noir writers, and it was fun to try and think about a noir that's enacted by children. You think of noir as being full of sex and violence, and those are two things that don't happen a lot in children's books directly. And it was fun to think about a small group of children, which is what happens in the series All the Wrong Questions, that Lemony Snicket is 13 years old, and then there are other people of similar age in this lonely town, and they are investigating this sinister and shadowy world that resembles the deranged plots of noir mysteries.
The kids get the noir thing. They, you know, you see so many they might not know exactly, you know, what they're getting into, but they seem to gravitate toward it in the way that you see, for example, children's characters with all wearing trench coats, that way of storytelling. Are you surprised that maybe someone didn't approach this sooner for kids?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that on one hand, the deceptive world of noir is similar to that of childhood. And that's kind of where this series, All the Wrong Questions, came from, is that I began to realize that the journey of a noir detective was like the journey of a child, that you're investigating things, that the world is far more sinister than you thought. Everyone is lying to you, and yet it's alluring, and you're drawn into it. And that's the journey of childhood to adulthood, I think. And I guess there have been some other attempts at doing noir for children, but I like to think I'm at least halfway original. And at least I ripped off Raymond Chandler this time, who was long dead before he would have learned of this.
Well, people do get that overwhelming sense from your books that we should resign ourselves to the notion that life is full of cruelty and misfortune. And is there anything in particular that happened to you as a kid that you used as inspiration or that informed some of your work?
Well, I think it was just the sensibility of growing up this generation Jewish, frankly. my father fled Germany in 1939 with his family, and you'll never guess why. And the stories that were around my dinner table and when the extended family got together were the stories of nations going mad and desperate escapes. And I think that certainly colored my worldview. But even had that not been the case, what I was interested in reading from a very young age were fairy tales and other pieces of culture in which children are alone in a sinister and often violent world. So I think that's something that most children grasp instinctively. Many people will say, oh, these Lemony Snicket books are teaching children that the world is full of trouble. And I think children know that the world is full of trouble. It's not teaching them that. It's just a story about that. And it's a story that they recognize because they see the troubled world we're in. Even in Pittsburgh, where all seems charming, there could be sinister things lurking.
The children in your books, they're wise characters. And while the adult characters, they seem to plot along at various levels of incompetence.
Yeah.
Are you simply trying to prepare kids for that day when they realize that their parents, who once seemed to have all of the answers, turn out to be clueless?
Oh, well, I think children learn that very easily. That's another thing that I don't have to teach children. Children figure that out all by themselves. I mean, I have a very charming son, but he nevertheless figured out at an extremely young age that the explanations I was giving him for the world didn't quite make any sense. I remember a very, very early conversation with him where we were listening to the Beatles in the car, and he said, are the Beatles actually Beatles? And I said, no, they were people. And he said, were they pretending to be Beatles? And I said, no. And he said, were they pretending to be Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band? And I said, yes, I think so. And slowly I realized that everything I knew about the world was slipping out of my grasp. That even such a very simple question, right? What he wanted to know is, why would a group of adult people call themselves Beatles? I know it's spelled differently, but nevertheless, where did that come from? That a musical ensemble would just call itself something that it wasn't. And the Beatles, which is relatively normal. Think about, you know, Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And so I think a suspicion of adult explanation and a realization of the incompetence of the people who are running the world comes very early to children.
You're trying to explain something that seems simple at first, and all of a sudden the wheels are coming off the wagon.
I just came from visiting a middle school. I didn't have to explain to middle school students, oh, we don't know what we're talking about, by the way. They know that all the time.
They've already figured that
out. They've already been tricked into a system where they have to study something and think about something for 30 minutes really hard, and then a bell rings, and then they run down a hallway to another room where they say, don't think about what we were just telling you to think about. Think about something else now. We're not thinking about the history of World War I. That's not what we're doing. Right now we're doing math. That's crazy. If you were asked to do this as an adult, you'd have a nervous breakdown.
What are some of the most interesting reactions that you've received to your books from adults?
From adults? Oh, I mean, everything from delight to horror, I would say. I've received the full spectrum of emotions. And certainly there are some people who say, I saw these books and I was horrified and terrified of them, and I thought they were inappropriate for my child, so I didn't give them to my child. And then my child brought them home from the library and loves them and is delighted. And what have you done? And why won't you do it to me? Or why won't it stop? Things like that. Yeah, very passionate responses.
And why do you think that Snicket's dark stories resonate so well with children?
Well, I think it speaks to the injustice of the world, and it speaks to where the imagination goes and strays. When you're very young, you're being taken care of by adults. And even if the adults just disappear for 5 minutes or leave you alone one night for the babysitter so they can finally get out of the house, have a few gimlets, you as a child begin to think, oh, they're gone. What would happen if they were gone all the time? Which is why there's so many orphans in children's literature. And it's also a very easy way to tell a story. If you kill off the parents, then the children can finally do something. If the children had parents in a children's book, and then they say, oh, we'd like to solve a murder, and the parents would say, you guys stay home. That's not your job. But if the parents are dead, then they can go out and do things. It's very handy.
So
in a book.
That's the vehicle for telling the story. You get the parents out of the way, and then the adventures begin. You sought out a new illustrator for this latest series of books.
It's true.
And
he's from Canada. Can we say that on public radio?
I think so. We can divulge right. that. But I'm curious how tricky it is for you as a writer to illustrate your work. And are you ever concerned about having images get in the way of what a kid might picture in his or her mind minus the illustration? For example, like the setting with the Stain by the Sea.
Yes.
A town that is no longer near the sea.
Well, it's true. The new series takes place in a town called Stain by the Sea, and the sea has been drained away by the local industry, and so Stain by the Sea is no longer by the sea. But
now you illustrate that.
Well, I worked with an illustrator.
Right.
But while I was working on this book, I saw a drawing by the illustrator Seth, who's best known for a series of lonely graphic novels. And the drawing was of a small seaside town, and it looked very lonely and desolate, and it felt like exactly what I was writing about. And so I went and tracked him down at a comics convention, which was quite funny because he was surrounded by, you know, Meet the Human Torch and see a preview of The Walking Dead. And there he was in a nice suit, lonely signing copies of his work. And I sought him out, and I asked him if he would illustrate it. And he actually resists the term illustrator. So it says art by Seth in the book, precisely because he doesn't see it as choosing something and drawing a picture of it, but rather coming up with drawings that kind of enhance the story. But certainly the decision about what to have pictures of and what not to have pictures of in the children's book is a huge conversation. And in a chapter book like this, where there are a million things you could have pictures of and don't, it's really, I mean, I think it's a more crucial part of the conversation than actually what the art looks like is what the art is going to depict.
Daniel Handler's latest work is When Did You See Her Last? And this is a prequel to the series of Unfortunate Events books. Daniel Handler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. You have a charming home.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. We welcome your comments and story ideas at esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can catch the entire show at wesa.fm or as a podcast. This is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR station. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening.